for this January 26th. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us, and here are your Tuesday headlines. The Senate sending a strong signal that there are not nearly enough votes to convict former President Donald Trump in next month's impeachment trial. In a 55-45 vote, lawmakers setting aside a motion by Kentucky Republican Rand Paul to declare the looming trial unconstitutional. In tabling that motion, the following Republican senators did side with the Democrats: Mitt Romney of Utah, Ben Sass of Nebraska, Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. The Hill newspaper writing the following quote: "Today's vote is the clearest sign yet that Donald Trump is heading toward a second acquittal." And it comes on the same day senators were sworn in to serve as jurors. Also today, a slower-than-expected vaccine rollout prompting the president to call for more action. It comes as a number of countries, including the U.S., are seeing a new strain of the virus. For example, Germany now considering almost completely halting flights into the country as a way to slow the spread of more infection strains of coronavirus. We'll get the very latest from Time Magazine's health and medicine reporter. Here in Washington, Janet Yellen sworn in as the Treasury Secretary, the Senate confirming Tony Blinken to head up the State Department, and President Biden having his first phone call with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The story shaping Washington today. It's all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin with the very latest on COVID-19. Earlier today, the world surpassing more than 100 million known coronavirus cases, a milestone that comes with a growing concern over a new variant of the disease and, for the moment, a shortage of vaccines. The New York Times is reporting that the 100 million figure is most likely underestimating the true number of cases, given the lack of adequate testing in some parts of the world and contact tracing in many countries, including here in the U.S. And according to Johns Hopkins University, globally, more than 2 million people have died. Here in the U.S., the number has exceeded 420,000 deaths. Health experts also worry that the new variants of the virus could bring a resurgence in the U.S., as we've seen in Britain, Ireland, and parts of South Africa. Those fears have prompted new lockdowns and travel restrictions around the world. And at least one case of that new coronavirus variant has been confirmed in Northern Virginia. Earlier in January, we learned of a case in Maryland. At the White House late this afternoon, President Biden announcing plans to step up the allocation of vaccines across the country.
But I also want to be clear, 100 million shots in 100 days is not the end point. It's just the start. We're not stopping there. The end goal is to beat COVID-19. And the way we do that is to get more people vaccinated, which means we have to be ready after we hit the ground, after we hit the goal of 100 million shots in 100 days. Now, that means fewer than 100 million people getting totally vaccinated. It means 100 shots. And it means somewhere between 60, maybe less, maybe more million people will have that, because it requires two shots in many cases, not always. So today I'm directing COVID-19 response coordinator Jeff Zients here to work with the Department of Health and Human Services to increase our total supply of vaccine for the American people. And we believe that we'll soon be able to confirm the purchase of an additional 100 million doses for each of the two FDA-authorized vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna. That's 100 million more doses of Pfizer and 100 million more doses of Moderna, 200 million more doses than the federal government had previously secured, not in hand yet, but ordered. We expect these additional 200 million doses to be delivered this summer, and some of it will come as early, begin to come in early summer, but by the midsummer, that this vaccine will be there. And the order, and that increases the total vaccine order in the United States by 50%, from 400 million order to 600 million. This is enough vaccine to fully vaccinate 300 Americans by end of the summer, the beginning of the fall.
Those comments late today by President Biden, and joining us from New York is Alice Park. She is national correspondent for Time Magazine, covering health and medicine. And let me begin with the issue of the vaccine shortages that we're seeing in so many parts of the country. Why is that happening?
I think it's a combination of factors. First, we've got a new vaccine that's being manufactured for the first time. It's also being manufactured at a scale that's really unprecedented and that we haven't done in at least a century. So I think those reasons, I think if we look back at the past year to and talk to experts in the field, they also point to some of the lack of leadership we had at the federal level to have a real national and sort of centralized guidance on how we're going to distribute and allocate these vaccines and actually get them not just off the manufacturing, you know, sites, out of the manufacturing sites, but into the arms of people. I think we saw some real issues there with the federal government kind of stopping at just delivering the vaccines to states and other jurisdictions and kind of leaving it up to them to then figure out how they were literally going to get those shots to pharmacies, to hospitals, to doctors' offices. And that's where you're seeing, I think, some of the issues come up now.
And as you look at the distribution process across the country over the last couple of weeks at the end of the Trump administration and now with the Biden administration, what's working and what's not?
Well, I think what's working is that there has to be a combination of a federal and local response, right? So you can't have the federal government responsible for the entire process because each state is different. The needs for each state are different. The resources of each state are different. So I think you need to have a combined federal and local response. And I would say in the past year, it's really been lopsided toward the federal side with very little support given to the more local side. And that's what states have been saying is both in terms of funding and in terms of just planning and support and planning. That hasn't been there. So we're seeing that begin to improve. And I know that that's one of the Biden health team's priorities is to listen to what the states are saying and figure out what they need in order to really set up more vaccination clinics to make sure that they're staffed with the properly trained people and that the public in general, as we move from vaccinating the very first priority groups to the general public, that the public is educated and comfortable about the vaccine and has their questions answered so that, the shots can be given and people are comfortable getting them.
And of course, the latest issue in all of this is this new variant, this new mutant strain that you write about tonight at time.com. What do you know about this and just how serious potentially can it be?
Well, there's several mutants, and the first thing I think we all need to understand is that viruses mutate. It's simply what they do. They're very opportunistic, and they're one of the – there's even some controversy over whether we can even call them, quote, living things, because unlike most living things that we know of, they don't have the ability to reproduce themselves. They can only create more copies of themselves if they infect another cell, whether that be human or animal. So they mutate all the time. And what we're worried about are two different scenarios that could really lead to dangerous or even bad health outcomes because of that. And the first is what I call the super mutant. And this is like that single bullet in Russian roulette where mutations happen and most of them are blanks, but there could be the one that's a killer. It spreads faster from person to person, and once it infects someone, it can really cause severe disease. So that's one scenario. The second scenario is more like, I think, like an aging car, where one thing could go wrong, like your tire pressure gets low. And by itself, that may not be such a big deal, but if you add that to a bunch of other small, you know, relatively benign things like a cracked windshield, no rearview mirror, and then you get on a highway, you know, you could have some problems. And viral mutations are like that too. They keep generating mutations, most of which on their own really aren't a big deal, but sometimes when they're combined, the effect is greater than each one alone. And could cause some real health issues. So what we're seeing now, I would say, is that we're still not at the point where we're concerned, and we're not at the point where we see any scientific evidence that the vaccine cannot protect against these mutants. So far, the studies that have been done, Moderna just released a report yesterday showing that their studies show that the people who are vaccinated with their vaccine generate sufficient antibodies to neutralize the virus. What's concerning is that against one of these mutants, the one that originated in South Africa, those people who are vaccinated generate sixfold lower levels of those antibodies. Those levels are still sufficient to protect, but they are lower. And so we're at the point now, I think, where it's concerning, but no reason to panic yet. But you can bet that researchers, both at the pharmaceutical companies and at the National Institutes of Health, are looking into these mutations and keeping track of the mutations very carefully to better understand if any of these do break through, you know, in that Russian roulette example, or whether any combination of them does seem to break through from the vaccine protection.
The very latest at time.com, Alice Park, national correspondent. She's joining us tonight from New York. We thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
The president's nominee to head up the Commerce Department, Rhode Island Governor Gina Raimondo, appearing remotely before the Senate Commerce Committee for her confirmation hearing today. She took a number of questions on the 2020 census, stating that she would treat the census differently, vowing to take the politics out of the once every 10-year count. And the Rhode Island governor also discussing the department's role in dealing with an economic slowdown, reinvesting in workforce for displaced Americans, and also how tackling the threat of climate change can be coupled with the creation of good-paying jobs. So on the climate issue, here is that exchange with Hawaii Senator Brian Schatz.
You mentioned in your testimony that Commerce has the tools and expertise to help communities and businesses address climate risk. Can you just talk about your top two or three priorities under existing statute?
Thank you and good morning. There are a number of ways that Commerce could influence climate, but most principally through NOAA. As I said, some of the best scientists around atmospherics and oceans are at NOAA and are at the department. So I would really look forward primarily through NOAA to address the climate issues posed by warming oceans, ocean debris, rising tides, the issues around fisheries and climate, to lead again with science and rely on the experts in the department. I think there's a very big role for NOAA to play in the blue economy, but also as we meet the challenges of climate.
And of course, NOAA is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, part of the Commerce Department, and the confirmation hearing for Rhode Island Governor Gina Raimondo earlier today. Additional hearings scheduled for this week, including tomorrow, the president's nominees for the Departments of Energy and Veterans Affairs. Progress today on a power-sharing deal in a 50-50 Senate. Democratic and Republican leaders reaching an agreement which will allow Democrats to take control of the committees as they try to advance the president's agenda. Democrat Chuck Schumer and Republican Mitch McConnell, they've been haggling over the Senate rules for the last couple of days as Democrats formally took over control of the chamber last Wednesday. A breakthrough did not come until two of the chamber's most conservative Democrats saying that they would vote against getting rid of that legislative filibuster. That's Senator Manchin of West Virginia and Sinema of Arizona, both saying they intend to keep that 60-vote threshold on legislation. We begin on the Senate floor with Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York.
Now on the organizing resolution. Well, since the last time I addressed this chamber, there has been notable progress in my discussions with the Republican leader about organizing the Senate. Last night, the Republican leader dropped his demand for additional provisions on the organizing resolution and will agree to the 2001 rules that last governed a 50-50 Senate, exactly what Democrats proposed from the start. I am glad the Republican leader finally relented, and we can move forward now to organize the Senate, set up committees, chairs, and ranking members, and a process for moving bills and nominees to the floor from committees with an evenly divided number of members. I'm glad we're finally able to get the Senate up and running. My only regret is that it took so long, because we have a great deal we need to accomplish over the next several weeks and months.
And that from the Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer. And by the way, back in 2001, the Democratic leader in the Senate, Tom Daschle of South Dakota. We are scheduled to talk with him on Thursday for our podcast, The Weekly. to explain just how that came together and his views on the Senate today. That's C-SPAN Radio's podcast, The Weekly. Democratic Vice President Kamala Harris holding the tie-breaking vote in the full chamber. Of course, this deal will set the stage for Democratic senators to take the reins of the committees. They will include Bernie Sanders, who will head up the Budget Committee, Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden, who will head up the Senate Finance Committee, Ohio Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown, he will head up the Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee, and Washington Democratic Senator Patty Murray, she will head up the HELP Committee, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. Now in the minority, here is Republican leader Mitch McConnell. He met with reporters on Capitol Hill.
As you may remember, on the subject of the legislative filibuster, I resisted a number of different, rather aggressive tweets during the Trump administration on the subject of reducing the legislative filibuster, getting rid of it in effect and reducing the legislative threshold 51. That only protected the Democratic minority in the Senate for the whole 4 years. I thought it was appropriate for Senator Schumer to make the same statement publicly that I had when I was in a similar situation, and that was not forthcoming. Fortunately, there are other Democrats. Senator Manchin yesterday made it clear he was not going to support getting rid of the legislative filibuster under any circumstances for the duration of this Congress. I talked to Senator Sinema last night. She said the same thing. So the issue, as far as I'm concerned, is resolved. And of course, it would have produced nothing, because without the supermajority threshold, the Senate would have been sitting there at 50-50. The vice president doesn't count for a quorum. Anytime the minority wanted to deny the majority a quorum, all we'd have to do is have somebody not show up. In other words, it would not have produced the kind of streamlined Senate that those on the progressive left across the country had convinced themselves that it was, sort of the Holy Grail. If you can grab that, all of our problems are solved. They would not have been solved. It would have only exacerbated the way the Senate works. The way we need to go forward in a 50-50 Senate is to have things that appeal to 60 votes on the legislative calendar. So that is the only, was the only impediment to moving ahead. Senator Schumer and I will be able to adopt an organizing resolution that's very close to exactly what was negotiated by Lott and Daschle after the 2000 election, when we also ended up with a 50-50 Senate.
With more on the developments in the U.S. Senate, we're joined on the phone Lindsay McPherson. She covers Congress for CQ Roll Call. First, with this new power-sharing agreement, how will the Senate operate in the foreseeable future?
Basically, the debate over the power-sharing agreement was whether to follow the 2001 rules as written or to add language preventing the Democrats from abolishing the legislative filibuster. McConnell pushed for that for about a week, but he ultimately relented on getting specific language regarding that after two Democrats, Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, said they wouldn't vote to abolish the filibuster. So the power-sharing agreement is set to move ahead basically the same as it was in 2001.
Let me turn to this $1.9 trillion stimulus bill, which is one of the centerpieces of the Biden administration's work with Congress. Where does that stand? And we're hearing that the timeline of this could be late February, March, before it actually comes to Congress.
Yeah, Biden has been trying to negotiate with Republicans. His first goal is to get a bipartisan deal on the plan. But so far, Republicans are not really thrilled with the proposal. They think $1.9 trillion is a lot, especially since Congress just passed roughly $900 billion in December before the new session started. They think that, you know, because a lot of that money hasn't even gone out yet, that there's no justification for another $1.9 trillion this early. So the administration is working with them. They've sent some data over to some of the senators who've requested it and justification, and the negotiations are ongoing. But there's no indication at this point that there'll be any broad bipartisan support. So Democrats are already starting to prepare for the budget reconciliation process, which would allow them to move the COVID relief under the budget process with a simple majority vote in the Senate. They have said that a budget resolution could come to the Senate floor as soon as next week, ahead of the impeachment trial, so that they could work on that, in committee and then have a vote after the impeachment trial on the actual plan.
And, of course, the new chair of the Senate Budget Committee is Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont.
Yes. He has been pushing really hard for reconciliation. He told me when I asked about the timeline for moving the reconciliation measure and getting the budget through that he wanted it done yesterday, and that was yesterday. So, I mean, obviously can't go back in time, but he's ready to move as soon as the leaders sign off, and I think that they're trying to get that done very quickly.
And, of course, the other major development today on the impeachment trial, as the senators were sworn in, the single article of impeachment brought over from the House to the Senate early last evening. So what does it look like over the next couple of weeks?
Well, basically what happened today is they swore the senators in for the trial, and then Rand Paul wanted to have a vote. He raised a constitutional point of order, arguing that the trial should not proceed because it's unconstitutional in his mind to impeach a former president. That they say the Constitution only provides impeachment as a remedy for active president for removal. Ultimately, the Democrats moved to table Paul's point of order, and it was tabled, which killed it. But what it showed, the vote was 55 to 45. Those 45 voting against tabling were Republicans who largely sided with Rand Paul, that they believe that holding a trial now that Trump is out of office is unconstitutional. So it really shows us that there's not likely to be the support needed to convict Trump when the trial proceeds. They're scheduled to resume on February 9th with the oral arguments. After the next few weeks, House managers and Trump's defense team will be submitting legal briefs and written filings. But it seems to be whatever they argue, it doesn't seem like it'll convince enough senators, given that most Republicans think it's unconstitutional to begin with. And in the Senate, you need 2/3, which is 67 senators, to vote to convict.
And of course, we will follow the trial and carry it live on C-SPAN 2 and your reporting at rollcall.com. Lindsay McPherson, we thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
At this time, I will administer the oath of the senators in the chamber in conformance with Article 1, Section 3, Clause 6 of the Constitution and the Senate's impeachment rules. Will all senators now rise and raise their right hand?
That from Vermont Senator Pat Leahy, the President pro tem. He will preside from the Senate chamber as lawmakers officially sworn in. Historically, this marks the fourth time in our country's history the Senate would hold a trial against a president: Andrew Johnson, Bill Clinton, last year Donald Trump when he was in office, and now as a former president, the second impeachment trial against the 45th president. It was last night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time we carried live as the House managers formally delivered a single article of impeachment charging that the president was responsible for inciting the violence resulting in the deaths of five individuals on January 6th and the damage across Capitol Hill. Maryland Democrat Jamie Raskin will be taking a leading role in the Senate trial.
In his conduct while President of the United States and in violation of his constitutional oath faithfully to execute the office of the President of the United States and to the best of his ability preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States and in violation of his constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, Donald John Trump engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors by inciting violence against the government of the United States.
That from Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland, one of the House managers, reportedly writing that as the violence was ensuing on January 6th, he was inside the Capitol along with several family members who were not hurt. Well, today it came with new questions on whether it is even constitutional for a former president, who is now a private citizen, to be impeached. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky forcing a procedural vote on the constitutionality of the trial. It amounted to what is the first real test on how Senate Republicans view this upcoming trial. Bringing a response from Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, here is how it unfolded on the Senate floor.
Section 4 of the Constitution says the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Article 1, Section 3, Clause 6 states, when the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside. As of noon last Wednesday, Donald Trump holds none of the positions listed in the Constitution. He is a private citizen. The presiding officer is not the Chief Justice, nor does he claim to be. His presence and the Chief Justice's absence demonstrate that this is not a trial of the president, but of a private citizen. Therefore, I make a point of order that this proceeding, which would try a private citizen and not a president, a vice president, or civil officer, violates the Constitution and is not in order.
Under the precedence of the Senate regarding constitutional points of order, including those of the Senate while sitting as a court of impeachment, the chair submits the question to the Senate. Is the point of order well taken?
Mr. President.
The Majority Leader.
The theory that the impeachment of a former official is unconstitutional is flat out wrong by every frame of analysis. Constitutional context, historical practice, precedent, and basic common sense. It's been completely debunked by constitutional scholars from all across the political spectrum. Now, the junior senator from Kentucky read one clause from the Constitution about the Senate's impeachment powers. He left out another from Article 3, Section 2, quote, "Judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States," unquote. If the framers intended impeachment to merely be a vehicle to remove sitting officials from their office, they would not have included that additional provision, disqualification from future office. The Constitution also gives the Senate, quote, "the sole power to try all impeachments." So what have past Senates decided on this question? In 1876, President Grant's Secretary of War, William Belknap, literally raced to the White House to tender his resignation before the House was set to vote on his impeachment. Not only did the House move forward with the impeachment, but the Senate convened a trial and voted as a chamber that Mr. Belknap could be tried, quote, "for acts done as Secretary of War, notwithstanding his resignation of said office." The language is crystal clear, without any ambiguity.
That from the Senate floor, and a constitutional lesson from Senator Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader, and before that, Republican Senator Rand Paul. Of course, the trial officially begins on February 9th. And again, as we said at the top of the program, the vote on that motion by Senator Paul, 55-45, but Republicans siding with the Democrats, including Romney of Utah, Sass of Nebraska, Collins of Maine, Murkowski of Alaska, and Toomey of Pennsylvania. But of course, it takes 2/3 majority to convict the president, or now the former president. And right now, the Democrats do not have enough votes. We'll continue to follow the story and again have live coverage on the C-SPAN networks. You're listening to Washington Today. For this Tuesday, January 26th, this is Washington Today. Here are some of your other headlines. If you live and work in the Northeast, you may have had trouble working online. A widespread internet outage impacting much of the Northeast today, causing issues for Amazon's web services, Google, Zoom, YouTube, Verizon, Slack, and several others. And under his tenure, the Washington Post earning 10 Pulitzer Prizes. Marty Baron announcing today he is stepping down as the executive editor next month. Before coming to the Post, he oversaw the Boston Globe coverage of the sexual abuse by priests across Massachusetts. It was featured in the film Spotlight, which went on to win the Academy Award for Best Picture back in 2015. Marty Baron's last day at the Washington Post is February 28th. Now more on impeachment. At today's White House briefing, Press Secretary Jen Psaki once again saying that the president does support a Senate trial against former President Donald Trump, telling reporters it is, quote, "the constitutional duty of Congress."
On another matter, on impeachment, the president yesterday in an interview said that he did not believe that former President Trump would be convicted and therefore removed from office, but said he felt like it had to go, the trial had to go on anyway. Could you please explain what he meant by that?
Sure. Well, let's put this in context of last night. So last night, the House impeachment managers delivered the articles of impeachment to the Senate with a dramatic walk over, as you all carried on television. The president was referencing a fact that he referenced in his statement of just a couple of weeks ago when the House passed the articles of impeachment themselves, which is that now it, of course, will move on to the Senate. As he also said at the time, he hopes, and I'll quote him here, the Senate leadership will find a way to deal with their constitutional responsibilities on impeachment while also working on the other urgent business of the nation. He still continues to feel that way. So last night they delivered the articles. The next step, as you all have reported and people watching at home know, is for the Senate to proceed with their trial. He's going to allow them to move forward at the pace and manner that the leaders in the Senate determine. And I can promise you that we will leave the vote counting to leaders in the Senate from now on.
Last follow-up and then hand off. On this, though, why is the president so reluctant to express his personal opinion as to what happens here? We understand he's not in the Senate anymore, mm-hmm. but he is the leader of the Democratic Party. Why won't he say what he believes should happen?
Well, the president believes that the Senate has the constitutional duty to proceed as they see fit on holding the former president accountable. He spent 36 years in the Senate. He's no longer there. As the president of the United States, he feels his role is to deliver on what he promised for the American people. So that's what he's trying to do every day.
And that's from the Brady briefing room at the White House with Press Secretary Jen Psaki. And according to the Washington Post, Democrats are concentrating their case around Trump personally, both what he said in the run-up to the January 6th attacks in the U.S. Capitol and a rally earlier that day, how his words were interpreted within the White House and those of his supporters. The website justsecurity.org has put together a 10.5-minute video that may be just one example of how the Democrats will be approaching the trial. In this exchange, one of those demonstrators who was leaving the rally by the White House and heading to the U.S. Capitol had this to say.
This is your revolution, buddy.
Thank you. Thank you.
Speech is over. It was awesome. Some of you may have seen it online. It went over all the voter fraud. I am very concerned about Mike Pence. I have no idea what he's going to do. Did not love the way the president talked about that. And I don't know. We'll see. Anyways, we're walking over to the Capitol right now, and I don't know, maybe we'll break down the doors.
Open your Alex Jones!
Yes, sir, everyone you know, go to the other side of the Capitol. That's where Trump's going to be.
The scene on January 6th, put together by the website justsecurity.org. In other news, the president is speaking with Russian President Vladimir Putin earlier today, marking the first call between the two leaders since Joe Biden was elected. In a readout of the conversation, President Biden reportedly pressing the Russian leader on the SolarWinds hack and the poisoning of opposition leader Alexei Navalny. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki telling reporters that the call took place intended to communicate the Biden administration's desire to seek a full 5-year extension of the New START nuclear arms treaty with Russia. And by a vote of 78-22, the Senate today confirming Tony Blinken to be President Biden's Secretary of State. He is fourth in line of succession to the presidency. His confirmation will make him the 71st Secretary of State and the fourth member of Biden's cabinet to be confirmed. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen sworn in earlier today by the Vice President, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, and the Director of National Intelligence, Averill Haines, confirmed last week. More confirmation hearings continue. You can follow the coverage online at cspan.org. The president ordering an intelligence assessment to uncover what he calls the origins and roots of violent white nationalism in the wake of the attack on the U.S. Capitol. During her first briefing as the new White House domestic policy advisor, Susan Rice was asked about these new forms of extremism in our country and how the administration wants to combat it.
Going back to January 6th and what we saw just a few weeks ago at the Capitol, when we saw people roaming that building carrying Confederate flags, wearing anti-Semitic shirts, we saw lawmakers in that group, we saw firefighters in that group, we saw military veterans in that group. What are you doing to address this issue of white nationalism? And how concerned are you about the threat of from some of these groups leading into this impeachment trial in 2 weeks?
Well, I think we have seen, and it's been plain for all Americans on their television sets, just how serious a problem we face from nationalists and white supremacists who have demonstrated a willingness to resort to violence in some instances. And that is why the president has ordered the intelligence community to compile a comprehensive assessment of the nature of this threat and challenge and its origins and roots, and thus provide policymakers with inputs that will be very important to address this challenge. The National Security Council has set up a capacity within the NSC to focus on domestic violent extremism and to ensure that we are within the White House and within the interagency coordinating efforts to craft and implement policies that will address this. So we're taking it quite seriously.
And why doesn't this address the ICE private detentions?
It addresses the Department of Justice prisons in the first instance. It's silent on what may or may not transpire with ICE facilities. There was a Department of Justice Inspector General report in 2016 that underscored that private prisons funded by DOJ were less safe, less secure, and arguably less humane. This was the Obama-Biden administration took steps to end renewing of contracts for private prisons. Trump administration reversed that, and we're reestablishing it.
And, of course, the reference to ICE, Immigration's Custom Enforcement, that's from the domestic policy advisor Susan Rice, formerly an educator at American University before joining the Biden administration as a new policy advisor. That from the briefing room earlier today. Meanwhile, the president is ordering the Department of Justice to phase out its contracts with private prisons. It's one of a number of planks of the new racial justice agenda by the Biden administration. And it comes on a day in which he signed four additional executive orders laying out his racial equity plan. Among other items, the actions are aimed at combating discriminatory housing practices, reforming the prison system, as well as respecting sovereignty of tribal governments. More from the White House.
Unity and healing must begin with understanding and truth, not ignorance and lies. Today, I'm also issuing an executive order that will ultimately end the Justice Department's use of private prisons, an industry that houses pretrial detainees and federal prisoners. The executive order directs the Attorney General to decline to renew contracts with privately operated criminal facilities, a step we started to take at the end of the Obama administration and was reversed under the previous administration. This is the first step to stop corporations from profiting off of incarceration that is less humane and less safe, as the studies show. And it is just the beginning of my administration's plan to address systemic problems in our criminal justice system. Here's another thing we need to do. We need to restore and expand the Voting Rights Act, named after our dear friend John Lewis, and continue to fight back against laws that many states are engaged in to suppress the right to vote while expanding access to the ballot box for all eligible voters. Because here's the deal, and I'll close with this. I ran for president because I believe we're in a battle for the soul of this nation. And the simple truth is, our soul will be troubled as long as systemic racism is allowed to persist. We can't eliminate it. It's not going to be overnight. We can't eliminate everything, but it's corrosive, it's destructive, and it's costly. It cost every American, not just who felt the sting of racial injustice. We are not just a nation of morally deprived because of systemic racism. We're also less prosperous. We're less successful. We're less secure. So we must change, and I know it's going to take time. But I know we can do it. And I firmly believe the nation is ready to change. But government has to change as well. We need to make equity and justice part of what we do every day. Today, tomorrow, and every day. Now, I'm going to sign these executive actions to continue the work to make real the promise of America for every American. Again, I'm not promising we can end it tomorrow. But I promise you, we're going to continue to make progress to eliminate systemic racism, and every branch of the White House and the federal government is going to be part of that effort. Thank you.
And that from the White House earlier today with President Joe Biden. At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow was off 23 points. The Nasdaq was down nearly 10. The S&P losing 5 3/4. He became the face of the Trump administration when it came to the U.S. economy, and Fox Business announcing earlier today that Larry Kudlow, who served as the president's economic advisor, will soon host his own weekday program. This marks his return to cable. He was a former CNBC host. Larry Kudlow will start on Fox Business on February the 8th. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And all of C-SPAN's coverage available online anytime at cspan.org. I'm Steve Scully in Washington, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.
C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Every day we take your calls live on the air, on the news of the day, and we discuss policy issues that impact you. Coming up Wednesday morning, we talk about the Biden administration's manufacturing agenda with Alliance for American Manufacturing President Scott Paul. Then a preview of the confirmation hearing for President Biden's Energy Secretary nominee, Jennifer Granholm, and the new administration's energy policy agenda with END News reporter Leslie Clark. Watch C-SPAN's Washington Journal live at 7 Eastern Wednesday morning. And be sure to join the discussion with your phone calls, Facebook comments, text messages, and tweets.